Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, it's Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. And it's end of 2016. This will be our New Year's show. I'm here in Massachusetts traveling around with Jay and Mark Zapp. They're opening a new place up in Amesbury, Massachusetts. But we got a chance to come down to Salem, Mass. And visit with Chris Loring of Notch Brewing, someone that I've been waiting to meet for a long time. And we're going to talk about the state of Massachusetts beer and some other stuff. But anyways, cheers, guys. Welcome to the show. Cheers. You know, this is one of these travel shows, so we got a little remote mic, and we're sitting here in a beautiful old brick building right on this water in Salem. Chris, tell us about this place, where we're at, you know, the history of this building and history of Salem. This is a cool place. We know about it for witches, but I've actually never been to Salem, Massachusetts.
Yeah, there's a lot more than witches in Salem. So this building was built in 1914, all brick construction. It was a Salem fire that wiped out the whole south side of the town, and this was one of the first buildings built after that. It was built for the REO Motor Car Company, which is, if you knew the band, REO Speedwagon. That was a truck that the REO company made. So we're in the back end, which is the garage. Actually, this is an old boiler room. It's on the South River. South River feeds in the Salem Harbor. So it's an old industrial building downtown that we're able to, you know, transition into something that's brewery, but also taproom, beer garden. It's a great spot. Salem has a great long history of trade, and then, you know, being really close to the water and taking advantage of that. And so, you know, being, you know, on the water was just a huge bonus for us. One of my must-haves with this brewery when we came to Salem was to have a beer garden. It was minimum 100-seat outdoor beer garden, because New England is, you know, we're Puritan culture, and it's very tough to find spots to drink beer outside where you're not force-fed a meal. Right, just be able to go out and have a beer and relax. So this was a really great thing. Not only an outside beer garden, but on the water. Just a home run for us.
Well, that's great. It's nice to be drinking a beer. I've been up in Massachusetts for a week, and I found it kind of hard to get craft beer at my package store. You know, where I'm from in Haverhill, there's a package store with, you know, I had a choice of something from Ipswich, which was good, and I ended up going for my old standby, Lagunitas IPA. But, you know, why is it? Like, I'm not seeing all these local beers in package stores and other stores around the state. Jay, you were telling me about that because I know you work at a package store.
Well, yeah, so I've been moonlighting at Leary's Fine Wine up in Amesbury, which is a great little kind of boutique spot, and they kind of really focus on wine and spirits, but they've got a decent beer selection. But it's difficult because, like what their beer buyer has been telling me, you know, people are no longer kind of loyal to brands or loyal to specific beers. There's so much out there that they're constantly rotating. So everybody's trying to drink what's new and what's hip. And it's kind of difficult for at least the package store to kind of keep up with that, you know, especially if they're not on top of the new breweries opening and what everybody's drinking. It's really difficult for them to bring something in, everybody buys it, and then they bring a bunch more in, and all of a sudden it doesn't sell again. So yeah, it's tricky. It's there's so many breweries out there now, and there's so many options, and that's one of the main things I hear. People come in and, you know, you see if you can help them, and I'm like, man, there's just so many choices now. Like, they look at the shelves and it's almost like they're dumbfounded, like what to choose. So, which, you know, pushes people towards, again, it's almost getting into where wine is for a lot of people. They buy wine by the label. You know, that's what a lot of people tell me. My wine knowledge is not as extensive as the beer knowledge, but, you know, selling people or helping people choose a wine, a lot of them say, hey, I'm looking for a nice label. You know, I just hope that the wine's kind of good.
Where do people get their craft beer in Massachusetts? Do they go directly to the breweries? Is that
been an ongoing trend. You know, it's something that we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years. Some of the legislation in Massachusetts changed. They made it easier for brewers to sell direct to the consumer. And previously, brew pub and license only, now manufacturers can sell directly to the consumer in taproom environments. And we've seen, you know, last year alone, maybe like, I don't know, 10, including Notch. You know, even though Notch has been around for 7 years, this was our first brick and mortar. And so it's the younger consumers, definitely we're seeing them come here. They're buying a lot of beer. And I think the wholesalers are starting to realize they're losing a little bit of money because the brewers want to go direct because they capture the margin. So it's a whole new dynamic. Where it ends, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the, leading to that. What's making our brewery, our venture, possible is being able to sell direct. I mean, you know that if you have to go through a distributor, you have to sell large margins. I mean, you have to work at such tight margins and sell a lot of beer in order to make money. So it becomes almost impossible for a small brewery to come out of the gate and actually make any money without working 24 hours a day. But now, if you're selling direct to the consumer with the new pour license that Massachusetts snuck in the middle of the night on a bill, thank God, it made it possible for breweries like Jay's and myself to be able to open up and just sell directly to the public.
Yeah, I think for us, I mean, opening Silvaticus in the space, Jimmy saw the space this morning that, like, without being able to have to pour a permit full beers, we wouldn't be able to open as a 7-barrel system.
No way.
And that space wouldn't work for us because it's not made for manufacturing, really. It's more of an intimate space. There's no loading dock. But we chose it because we want to be a destination where people can come and enjoy the beer there. And it really works because it's central in downtown Amesbury.
So, Chris, about Knott's, so you said before you were just contracting?
Yeah, so I've been a professional brewer for a long time. I started professional brewing in 1993 with Tremont in Boston. And then that sold to a competitor. And then when I started Knott's, just because the reasons we're talking about, the dynamics are, and session beer as well. So I brew all beers of modest and lower alcohol. And I'm not getting a large margin on my beers. To build a brewery that would be profitable without a tap room, in 2010 would have been impossible. I would have had to get to a scale of about 15,000 barrels to turn a profit. So, I mean, you can't grow into that because you're going to have just extremely a lot of debt or a rich parent. My route was contracting. Dirty word way back in the day, but because I'm a brewer, I was able to find facilities that would allow me to participate within the brews. Or brew it myself, and that really got me to where we are today. So, yeah, I don't know if I could do that today. It's so competitive right now that if I went into a contract situation today without that face to face contact with a consumer with a tap room, I don't know how you make that work. More has changed in the last 5 years in beer than I've seen in the last 25 years. It's just been a total change and shift in how people are consuming beer.
So when did the law in Massachusetts change?
I think 3 or 4 years ago. There were ways around it. It was just a little more convoluted. You could be a manufacturer, a small brewer, non-brew pub, and sell direct to the consumer. You had to get a beer and wine license from your local city or town. And a lot of the city and towns in Massachusetts are capped, so they weren't available or they were expensive. There's none of that anymore. As long as you have that small brewer's license, as long as the town says okay, you can get the license to sell. And that's why we're seeing so many small brewers appear. Without that, we wouldn't have seen the amount of growth we've seen in small brewers in Massachusetts. And that's great, because the reasons you mentioned at the top of the show is that there hasn't been a lot of local support for brewers. I've seen it for 25 years, and that Massachusetts struggled in terms of local brewers getting to the forefront. Yeah, we've had Harpoon, we've had Sam, but San Diego did better in Boston than any other local brewer did. Right? There was just transient consumer in Boston, a lot of college students. No one had a real affinity for local beer. But partly because there weren't a lot of them, right? And so now we have a lot more, and we have the experience. We can go to the tap room. That's really done a great thing for Massachusetts and Greater Boston in terms of cultivating a local beer scene.
And then the beer we're drinking. So you said you're focusing on session beers. This is nice. It's a rauch beer, but it's an easy drinking rauch beer.
Yeah. So everything we do is 4.5 and lower. It's an arbitrary number, but it's lower than standard. I have this mindset of beers have basically three general strength categories. There's normal, which to me is like 5 and above. There's strong, which is typically more than 6, and then lower than 5 is basically session or lower ABV. And people can debate that, but I don't really care. I just put my head down and do what I do. So all our beers typically fall into the 4, some in the 3s. Most are based in traditional styles. A lot of lager, a lot of Czech beers, some German. But I also do a lot of American IPA, not IPAs, session IPAs and pale ales. But we'll fool around with other things. We do sour, we do Berliner Weiss, things that really have a history of session beer. And for me, it was because when I started Notch in 2010, the beers that were available to me were strong and hoppy and boozy, and I don't like to drink that way. I mean, I like to drink half liters or liters over a longer period of time and not lose my wits too quickly, you know? So that's, beer to me is more
for refreshment.
Beer to me is not about, you know, overanalyzing and geeking out and you know,
it doesn't have
closing
to
yourself off from everyone around you because you're trying to, you know, get in tune with this beer. Beer to me is like, all right, this beer's great. Now let's talk. Let's do what we're doing right now. That's to me, that's the experience of beer.
So let's talk about this beer. So Mark, how does it taste?
This is fantastic. I mean, I think not only is this beer good, but the space is equally stunning. But this Rausch beer, it's really flavorful. The smoke is right on. I could drink the hell out of this beer, that's for sure. And you know, like you're saying, that a lot of people don't brew beers in these lower ABVs, and I think it's really hard to brew really flavorful beers at this alcohol percentage. I mean, you don't tread into this water easily. I think I'm complimenting you because I think this is not an easy session. Beers are not easy to make. I think it's much easier to throw a kitchen sink at it and make it boozy and hoppy than it is to do this. This has a lot of finesse and it's very rounded.
Thank you. I mean, I think the challenges with lower ABV beers are, they're just different challenges. I mean, at the higher end of ABV, it's about balance because you have so much going on and how all those flavors intermingle and, you know, can they have this succinct kind of flavor to them at the end. With session beer, it's that you have fewer opportunity to grab flavor from the ingredients, and how do you get as much flavor out as you want, as you need, and that's the challenge. But I don't, you know, harder, more difficult. I just think that any brewer who is skilled can eventually get there. It just takes iteration, it takes time, and it takes focus. Mm-hmm. And most people don't focus on lower ABV beer, so there's not a lot of great ones.
Right.
We have a ton of session IPA in the market right now, and I think 75% are just, you know, poor efforts. You know, 25% are awesome.
Yeah.
Because those brewers have spent the time to do it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not any brewer with you know, the skill to brew a higher ABV beer can certainly do a lower one. There hasn't been the focus there.
Right. You know? Well, you do it well, man.
Yeah, and what about this style? Because I'm used to, like, the Schlenker, like, stronger, like, almost syrupy, you know, smoked ales. Is this a traditional recipe, or is it something that you came up with?
Well, this is probably one of the ones that, you know, when you look at, you know, lager in particular, you look at Czech Republic, they don't do smoked beer. And so you look at Germany, they have, you know, Zwickel and some other styles that are traditionally a little lower. You know, Rauch beer isn't one you would think of as a low ABV beer. But this 4.5, you know, it's in a range of, like, a standard beer. But I wanted to be able to do something that had, you know, good smoke character that you could have multiple of. And so I had to split that smoke kind of down the middle of being very light but not being too intense. And so to me, this is like right in the middle of smokiness. And it's funny when you make a smoke beer, half the consumer's like, it's not smoky enough. And the other half the consumer's like, it's too smoky, right? There's never the perfect, like, this is right where we need it. But for me, this is where I need it to have like 3.5 liters and not get overwhelmed. And not with sweetness or smoke or intensity, but not so that it's bland or it's boring, right? Enough to entice you for that next half liter.
Jay and Mark, have you guys made a smoke beer before?
Well, ironically enough, we brought a 100% smoked beer lager that Jay and I did. I believe we used cherry wood smoke.
I think 70,
and a little bit of beechwood.
70 cherry wood and 30 beechwood.
Whoa,
but we went the full Monty on this one, the 100%, and it's been aging probably for about 5 or 6 months in my cellar, my proper cellar in New England. I'm glad we brought that because I'm curious to know what you think.
I'd love to try. Yeah, the rock beer we have here in the tap room now is 50% beechwood smoked. And the rest is just a variety of other malts. I'd be interested to try that.
Yeah.
You know, talking about malts, I think I was trying to think about how we first met. And you said it was Andrea Stanley at Valley Malt.
Right.
Might have been somehow introduced us.
Right, right. And so Valley Malt's been really fun to deal with, or work with, I should say. I've been using their grains for 5-6 years now. And, you know, part of the thing that to me was that, as a local brewer, and we just talked about local support, was that I asked my local pubs and retailers to support local. And when there was a local maltster, you know, I had to finish that promise and support them, because otherwise I'd be a hypocrite, right? And it's good that, you know, beer, you know, there's a criticism of, you know, beer's not local, all the ingredients come from all over the world, blah, 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 the only thing that's local is water. The labor's local. And that's the most important thing, because that money stays here. The money we spend goes back to our employees, and they spend it locally. So to have be able to buy grain locally and have that stay within New England is really important to me. So we use a variety of different grains from Valley Mall. We have on right now, we have basically a sour saison, dry hopped with El Dorado, and that's 100% Valley Mall wheat and pills, or pale, excuse me. So it's been able to fund to collaborate with them, and we're going to have a couple projects coming up with Valley Mall this year. We're going to focus on basically corn, malted corn in a variety of different roasts, everything from pale to amber to dark, and have a lot of fun with that, because those will make some very interesting lagers.
Chris is smiling when he said that.
I could see the wheels turning, yeah.
He started talking about the corn, and they started smiling.
I love corn as an ingredient. And when I cut my teeth as a brewer in 93, I was an apprentice at a brew pub. We brewed a lot of this really shitty light lager, and it had a lot of corn flake in it, or maize. And the beer was boring, but it was boring because the recipe was boring. But that flavor of corn stuck with me, and that it was very, very interesting. So, you know, I was able to start using corn in recipes, and it really kind of hit me, like, what a positive attribute corn could make to certain recipes. It's not a negative. It's not less expensive by any means, and it's not bland. It definitely has a character that, you know, if used the right way, is very, very interesting. So I'm a huge fan of using what is known as adjunct in a way that, you know, isn't traditionally done, you know, like the adjunct of corn as a cheapener or as a sugar. Like, yeah, I can understand why people don't like that, but you can turn that on its head and make something really unique with it.
Hey, it's like using the Death Star's weapons back on them, isn't it? Using corn in your beer. I mean, to actually, the larger breweries, they use it as a component to save money and not spend it on barley. And it's got that sort of distinct,
you know,
one-dimensional character.
I was trying to stay away from Star Wars.
you can't, dude, not when I'm here.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, we're up here in Massachusetts celebrating the new year. And don't forget to join heritageradionetwork.org, be a member, business member. Some of our new supporters are Threes Brewing in Brooklyn and Brooklyn Brew Shop. They've signed up recently, so go and support those guys. So we're up here at Notch Brewing in Salem. And I'm losing my mind because I've been looking for craft beer up here in Massachusetts, and now I'm getting it. So we had a great Rauch beer. Now we're on a second beer. But you know, Chris, you have a really cool system here. You got an interesting tap system. It's a great place to come. You got a beer garden in the summer right here on the water in Salem. Tell us about your tap system. I mean, that was a very unique, it's like a Czech style system.
Yeah, so I have this tap system that we imported from Pilsen in Czech Republic. And if you go to the Czech Republic, the way they pour their lagers is a little bit different than what we do here.
You gotta stop the
sound of Czech mug. That's great.
Yeah, these like real solid, thick glass mugs.
These also, Czech Republic as well. And so, you know, the reason that was important for me to do here is that you look at cultures that really embrace low ABV beer, and the Czech Republic is you know, the height of that, more so than even Britain, where the beer they consume the most of is a 4% Pilsner, or what they call pale lager. And the way they serve it's pretty unique, and that's what we have here. It's a tap system where instead of, you know, kind of like this piston arrangement that has a vertical throw that you have in the United States, this has a horizontal ball valve. And so the way that's served is the ball valve is opened only a little bit at the start. It creates foam, a restriction, and there's a little bit of, like, say, an inch or two of foam at the bottom of the mug. And the faucet is long and goes under that foam head. So it goes into the beer, which is, you know, typically in the United States, it's a no-no because those faucets can't come off. They can't be sanitized. They can't be cleaned. These faucets are cleaned. They can come off, you know, either periodically at the end of the day. So anyways, the faucet then is turned all the way on. The ball valve's turned all the way on. So you have clear beer coming out. And that clear beer then pushes up that foam that you created. And as you can see here, we get a really nice, tight, dense, creamy head.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that you'll find in the Czech Republic is this the idea of Pilsner in the United States is really, I think, one that is a little narrow in view. Because in the Czech Republic, Pilsner doesn't mean necessarily bright, crisp, highly carbonated, crystal clear. In the Czech Republic, you get some creaminess in those beers, and there's some malt sugar in those beers. And the way they pour the beer creates this kind of, you know, nice kind of creaminess as you drink through the foam. But it finishes dry and all that stuff, but you get that kind of like mouthfeel or that palate that most American consumers wouldn't associate to a Pilsner. So I think part of that's in the pour. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to get this. We'll finish with the pills before you go, and you get a sense of that. But that was really important for us because I wanted to pour Czech. I not only did I want to brew it in a very traditional fashion, we have a decoction system here, and we decocted all our lagers, but I wanted to make sure that we poured it in the same fashion that we do in the Czech Republic.
So you said you have that system to pour your lagers, but then you have the ales on a different tap.
And then we have 10 more traditional faucets that we use for our basic ales or, you know, anything that's not lager from the front.
So you were talking before about using corn as an ingredient. I mean, Jay, as a brewer, have you worked with corn or rice or
not,
other adjuncts?
Not a lot. I mean, for me, you know, coming in, and it was always kind of, you have like the stigma for corn, but I've talked to a lot of guys who have, you know, used it and more now that you can get it local and you can kind of use that flavor to influence the beer more and how, you know, it's not just to kind of cheapen
save
the
money.
Beer.
Yeah.
Exactly. But no, I haven't really worked with it at all.
I mean, one thing with Valley Malt, you're talking about them as a source. I feel like that the movement to have all different grains, you know, different types of rye has really been growing, and I like the differences in flavors from the grains. Do you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, so Valley Malt this year, what they're doing is they're doing these malt sensory analysis sessions, if you will, and they're getting brewers to try a number of different malts based on this new method of analysis where you can take the grains, you do what's called a Congress mash, and you get basically a sense of what that malt is without having to go through an entire brew. Mm-hmm. And so we sat down, this was probably just a couple weeks ago, it was myself and Wormtown, Cambridge Brewing Company, Throwback, we all sat down around a table and Andrea went through all of this, and she, you know, basically gave us grains that we knew, like Vireman and Simpson, you know, established maltsters, and then she did stuff that she did on her own, pilot, that were different grain heritage varieties. Because what she's trying to determine is what are the varieties that she wants the farmers to grow based on the brewer's input, which is fantastic. And there were a couple of grain, we did this blind, there were a couple of the varieties that she grew and malted. And she didn't grow, but she malted from the farmer, and I swore they were British malts. I was going to bet my life on it was a Fawcett malt, and it was a locally grown, wonderful malt. So we're starting to see an advancement of the quality of the local grains getting better. And that's because, you know, we've supported them, and they've been able to build their infrastructure, and now the demand's getting higher. And, you know, I hope to see that, even though it's difficult to grow barley malt, you know, in the New England region, there are certain varieties that do grow well and taste great, and that's really been a lot of fun to be a part of that.
And then the beer in glass right now. So this is, I like beer color. I like, the first one was a rock beer, a little amber. This is a little darker. What is this beer?
So that's Tmavé. Tmavé is Czech for dark. And so it's a dark lager. It's 4.4%. And this is one of the beers I had an epiphany with when I went to the Czech Republic. Because you go to the Czech Republic as this neophyte doing a lot about beer, which was me, you know, 15 years ago. And I saw this dark lager, and it was 4%. Alcohol, and it was wonderfully flavorful. It was malty without being sweet. It was interesting that you wanted to have, you know, a number of pints, but it wasn't cloying. And this has been a fun one for us because there's now in craft beer, there's the consumer thinks that dark means imperial stout, sweet and
right.
Boozy, and I can sip it and she come in a tulip.
Or that dark means higher in alcohol.
Higher in alcohol. And now we have a beer that is modest in alcohol, that's not cloyingly sweet, and you can drink 3 half liters and have a lot of fun with. So I mean, this is one of the styles I really love. It's not quite as dry as a Swartz beer, and it's not quite as sweet as a Dunkel. It kind of cuts right in the middle.
Yeah, it's lovely.
You know, it has a good palate fullness to it.
Yeah, I've had some Dunkels that can be too sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of sweet beers. I'll have one, but it's not something I drink multiple of. So this beer's been a lot of fun to do. We also have another version that's called Chardonnay. Chardonnay is Czech for dark. Excuse me, Czech for black. And so it's a slightly darker version. There's a little more roasty, a little more cocoa in the aroma, and that's what we have in cans. This is one we just did for the tap room.
So how do you get the color from the malts without making it sweet?
Well, so the color, this color comes from a malt called Carafa, and it's actually a huskless variety. So the husk is removed so that you don't have the tannins that would lead to this kind of like bitter, astringent kind of character to it, so it smooths it out a little bit. This isn't sweet because we don't start. This is a 12 Plato beer, so you're not starting out with a lot of sugar. 12 Plato is basically, I guess, for homebrewers, the 1048. If I'm doing my math right, I use Plato. And it finishes a little bit high because there's a lot of specialty malt in this. The base malts are Munich and Vienna. There's no Pils malt in this at all. So it gives that texture and flavor, but it's not going to be something that finishes with a sweetness. There's not a lot of crystal malt in this, which tends to get raisiny and kind of overly sweet. So it's just a balance of all those malts.
I can taste the Vienna in this. It's spectacular.
Thanks.
One thing about this type of beer... It's the kind of beer that makes you burp. Unlike some IPAs and other things. Is there a science behind that? Or is it just me having a fun day?
I can't even comment to that one. That's good.
No, this is really good. I mean, I spent a little time in the Czech Republic, so I share your fondness for the place because simple beers, but done so well.
Yeah.
You can't even, the Pilsner Urquell that they send over here is not even in the same universe as what you would drink over there.
Yeah.
And it's just, so it's nice to get this sort of ilk.
That's really what gets your jazz on, though, is Czech. I mean, is that really the place you look to most for inspiration?
It's definitely one of the spots. And, being the session beer brewer, they have a number of different styles that the United States doesn't even realize exists. And so it's been fun to kind of bring those to the forefront. We have another Czech amber on here called Polet Mávě. So Tamavi is dark, Polo means half dark. It's a really lousy way to explain a beer, right? But so those are the ones that get me excited because the Czechs do a really good job at nuance and subtlety, and because part of it's they make great beer because of the process and not so much like the overindulgence of too many ingredients or too many ingredients. It's really blending great quality ingredients and through process bringing out the best of those ingredients. And so Nate, who's our brewery manager, and I really dig are beers of nuance and subtlety and elegance, but are flavorful, right? That doesn't mean boring, right? And quality doesn't mean over the top, right? There's some other element of beer where it's been lost that subtlety and balance and nuance has a place, right? It's not a bad place because right now, and it's been going on for a while now, is that over the top, like every pale ale needs to be dry hopped, and 3 pounds per barrel needs to be the minimum, and if you can't smell it from across the table, it's not a good beer. And I get why people like that, right? There's a lot of fun with that, but this means something that is a pound per barrel is not good, right? It might be just a little bit more nuanced, but nuance is lost on a lot of people these days.
Well, I mean, European beer is a balance. It's all about balance, right? I mean, like you look at a Czech Pilsner is definitely has its own sort of flavor profile. You look at the German version of it, it's a lot more crisp, a lot more sharp, a little less in the diacetyl end. But they're all very well balanced. They may be a little bit different as per region, per water, per ingredients, but they're all the thread in these European beers is the balance. It's all about balance.
And balance leads to, for lack of a better word, drinkability.
Mm-hmm.
We don't serve flights here. I loathe flights. I think they're the antichrist of craft beer because it leads to sipping and tasting and evaluation and phone check-ins and antisocial behavior. right? Drink a whole half liter.
But do you have Wi-Fi here or not?
We do have it. We do have Wi-Fi.
Turn it off, man.
There's no TVs in here, though.
Well, thank God.
Drink a half liter.
This is a nice atmosphere for drinking.
Yeah,
beer,
no, right? I got you.
But the problem with flights is that you drink a 2 or 3 ounce sample, you might think that's a great beer. Put a half liter in front of you, you may get to the end of that pint and be like, this is cloyingly sweet and terrible.
Yeah.
Right? So flights lead to intensity of flavor, intensity of aroma that may work great on a 3 ounce beer, but work terrible on a half liter. Right? I want a beer that tastes good right to the end. And that takes nuance and subtlety and some skill. Right? Anyone can make something that tastes great in a 3 ounce sample. Right?
I agree. I'm always into what beer people order, not just one, but two or three or four.
Right.
The flight kind of seeps to the way.
You know, as a retail, that's how I judge, am I going to buy a beer again? People have to want to keep drinking it.
Yeah, like the flight kind of speaks to the way society is now. It's this very quick, instant response.
Short attention span.
Move right on to the next
thing. So it's like Instagram rather than really enjoying
where you're doing. To be able to sit down and enjoy.
I have to say on that note, this is, you mentioned there's no TVs here. Talking about a place to drink beer, I would come to Notch Brewing in Salem to hang out. I wouldn't even leave here.
Yeah.
Because, and the same thing, what you guys are opening in Amesbury, Mass., probably open by this summer, hopefully, is Sylvaticus. The same thing, you're in a historical building, you're next to the water, you'll have outdoor seating. When people want to go somewhere, they actually want to hang out. You know, our modern world is not set up for having a good time, you know, and by embracing what you're doing, by local ingredients, and having a craft product, that's what we're all about. That's what our life is about, you know? So cheers to you guys, man.
Yeah, cheers.
I'm getting charged on this stuff. And I could drink more of these. So. And then for Jay, have you made kind of dark lagers and these type of beers? Because you were at 49th State Brewing in Alaska for a number of years. Mm-hmm.
So
you came back
I studied in Germany for a while, so I kind of, my focus was on lagers, and I have this affinity for very similar, kind of sessionable, clean, malty, really well-made, refined beers. And when we started up 49th State, I was able to kind of, even though, you know, I was able to get in on the ground floor to kind of develop the beers and the styles that we serve. So we didn't just kind of do just like the colored beers. I was able to play around, and we did a number of, our light beer was a Helles, and our we did a Vienna Lager, which was our, you know, it could fall in the amber category, but similar. We're using some carafe malt to just give you the color, and we really have this really nice strong base of Vienna and Munich malt to give it some really nice flavor and nuances that is lost on a lot of people and a lot of brewers, you know, the same way. You know, I enjoy a beer like this 10 times more than a beer that's loaded with 5 pounds per barrel of hops, because it can be a little messy. Like, it's a little not... You know, there's, now don't get me wrong, there's some great beers out there, you know, that, especially up in this area, you know, the New England IPA, there's some breweries up here that like Chris was saying, they've been doing it for a while and they do it well, but there's a lot of other ones where it's just like, you know, you're just kind of throwing the kitchen sink at it, and just because you're putting a lot of boutique hops in it doesn't make it a good beer. And there's a lot of other underlying flaws in those beers that are kind of masked by the fact that all you taste and smell and burp is hops.
Yeah. I mean, and Jay worked up in a busy brew pub environment, and I was sort of, I went up and helped brew when he was in the middle of the season a number of times, and you know, he was able to churn out these really beautifully elegant lagers on a tight brew pub schedule in 30 days, which I thought was quite impressive. And so there's a sort of a myth around the fact that lagers need to be lagered for extended periods of time to be drinkable. I think if they're really balanced, they can be churned out fairly fresh. And Jay sort of, he didn't have the luxury of sitting on beer as he was able, he had to turn them out. And he was able to sort of execute them. So I knew that Jay was going to sort of feel at home here at Notch as soon as he started drinking some of these beers.
With Chris, how did you embrace that? You know, you started in 93, you were brewing other places. So you know, you're doing decoction method. Tell us what that is, because that seems to be the catchphrase that if you do decoction, your beer is better.
Yeah, so I don't think that's the case. I mean, to me, it was to be able to understand something new to me at a very, very intimate level. And so I started off as a British brewer. I apprenticed under a couple of British brewers. I went to Siebel, which is really a lager. At the time, it was really about lager. But I focused on ales for my first 10 years of my career, and so I wanted to learn more. And to me, it's like, if you're not learning, that leads to mediocrity. You always have to learn. Because those who want to learn, that's where mediocrity kind of breeds. And so what are we going to do here? with Notch. I love lagers. One of my first beers was Session Pils, and I did a single temperature infusion with it, and I lagered it, but I wanted to learn more. I wanted to learn more about how decoction had an influence over the beer, and I kept being told it wasn't necessary, and that modern malts are highly modified, and blah, 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 blah. And then I went to the Czech Republic. Every brewer there was like, you cannot substitute the flavors that we create with decoction with a single temperature infusion. You can't cheat with melanoid and malt. There's no shortcuts. And I love that, no shortcuts, right? So when we started Notch here, I wanted to make sure that we had the ability to prove out that decoction was something that had a positive attribute, even in the modern world of highly modified malts. And so decoction, for the folks at home, is where rather than taking malt, mashing, and leaving it at a single temperature, enzymatic reaction turns starch into sugar, and then basically you have wort. With decoction, is you have a schedule of different temperatures where at different sacrification temperatures, you're going to create different kinds of sugars. And the way you step those sacrification levels, or just either from protein to beta to alpha, you can do that through boiling portion of the mash and returning that mash back to the main mash and stepping those temperatures up. That's a very simple way to do it. Mash schedules can get very, very complicated with decoction. We've done a number of them. It's labor intensive. It's utility intensive. It's time intensive. A brew day that for a single temperature would be 8 hours or 6 hours is typically 11 to 12. But for me, it's been a lot of fun to see how those flavors are extracted and how the impact of decoction really comes through in beer, especially the pale lagers, which was my biggest surprise. Like I thought, dark, amber, those would really be like, you're creating a lot of melanoid and that's really going to shine. I found that in the pale lagers that we produce, that there's a complexity there that maybe the average consumer may not recognize, but I certainly do. And I certainly find it's worth the effort to do a double double decoction on our Czech lagers. But it's a long fucking day.
I'm the only guy here that's finishing all the beers, so we're taking a short break.
I'm talking too much.
You're great. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, we're up here in Notch Brewing in Salem, Mass. So, Chris, this is amazing. So, you had your separate lager tap. Now you've got taps for the ale. So, you set the bar up it's like a brewer's dream, right? You have quality control from start to finish.
Yeah, here in Salem, this is really our R&D. We have a 10-barrel brew house, which is not large by any standard, but allows us to do a lot of iteration of different things. Open, closed fermentation, horizontal lagering tanks, and
cheers.
Number of different yeasts that we use, and because we're not trying to, this is not our main production facility, we're not trying to crank out the same thing the same way every single time, which is a great challenge on its own, and I've been there, but what we're trying to do here is really identify flavors, process, ingredients that we like that we then scale and go elsewhere to consumers in cans. So we still brew a great portion of our beer out of Two Roads in Connecticut. We've been brewing there, I think since 2012, 2013, whenever they started. The year they started, we were there. And it's a great spot to brew beer. There's a lot of other world-class brewers brewing beer
there.
That's
like the little secret of New England brewing, right? I know Lawson's, a Sip of Sunshine, he makes his cans there. And in New York City, there's Evil Twin. And Stillwater Brewing out of there.
Yeah.
I mean, how did you find Two Roads?
Because
we know Phil Markowski.
Phil Markowski, man.
Great brewer.
Dude, he's like Yoda.
But did he track you down?
It was interesting. I heard from someone else that that Phil was doing this. I gave Two Roads a call. And I think just because I'd been in the industry for a while, that they allowed a meeting with me. And they saw that I was already in the market, had an existing beer that they brought me in, and it allowed me to transition to cans because I was in bottles at the point. I never wanted to be in bottles with this brand, with Notch. Notch is a session beer. Cans make a hell of a lot more sense. And so they're putting a canning line in within the first couple months of them opening. And that was a game changer for us. And then we came out with cans and 12 packs. And that is just huge volume for us.
So we see so many breweries now putting out can releases. Why did you say you didn't want to be in bottles and you want to be in cans?
I mean, session beer, it's at this point, it's kind of known, but you know, session beer, lower alcohol, makes more sense, you know, if you're on a boat, if you're, you know, doing activities like around a pool, if you're playing golf, or all these kind of, more active types of, you know, things where you want to drink beer but don't want an 8% beer, right? It made a lot more sense. And anywhere that makes sense, cans make sense as well. Absolutely. It's just more flexible. Bottles can't go everywhere. Cans can.
If you had a sound effect right now, I could crunch a can, but crunch. And Jay had some questions. So Jay was like so excited. Like, can we go see the brew system now? So what do you want to ask Chris? Because you're a great brewer, up-and-coming brewer. I love you, 49th State Brewing, and now you're opening in Sylvaticus up in Amesbury, Mass. What are some questions you want to ask Chris as a brewer?
I mean, for me, I'm just, you know, totally into the whole decoction system and seeing how, you know, knowing that you've been a brewer for a long time, like being able to build kind of, I don't know if it's your dream system, but being able to build it from your collective knowledge and kind of doing things the right way. Because as a brewer at 49th, we went through two expansions while I was there, and every time it was a learning experience for me because it was kind of on the fly and balancing production, but also, you know, what we wanted to do with certain beer styles, setting it up so we could do step mashing, things like that. So I just, you know, I'm just a, you know, brewer geek that just likes to see stuff and kind of, I mean, understand how process flow and see how because everybody does it also a little different too, because everybody has different experiences and like different reasons why they do things. So
yeah. I just, so you want to see his brew system?
I do.
Well, process guy, system. Man. Come on.
It may not be a dream system. I don't know if everyone ever brews a dream system, because after you brew on something for 6 months, you're like, you know, I could change this to this. There's always the little, you know, modifications.
But
you
not every make. And not every brewer gets to design his own system. You know, it's a lot of them.
It's a hell of a lot of pressure.
Somebody else does.
Better get this right, right? No, but I feel very fortunate I was able to do that. You know, I finally got to a point with Notch that, like, all right, here we go. It's our one chance. Hoping not our one chance, but the chance to make something really kind of cool from a system standpoint that has a great deal of flexibility. I mean, the beer we have in front of us right now is a single hop pale ale. Oh. Which comes out of the same system as our decocted beers. It's a single temperature infusion, straightforward. I use Golden Promise from Fawcett as our base malt. Love that because it coaxes a lot of flavor out of it. Mm. And so we're able to do, you know, a wide variety of things. I love low ABV, modest ABV pale ales. I mean, I just love them. And so it's been fun to brew a whole, you know, series of them here, and we'll continue to do that. As much as I'm a lager freak.
Let's talk about the nose on this beer. The nose on this beer is fantastic.
Thank you.
It smells like honeydew to me.
And tangerines.
I had nothing to really do with the nose. I mean, the funny thing about, I think, brewing pale ales is that the brewer has very little to do with, like, the aromatics that come out. It's the hop growers and the hop breeders who do all the damn work, and we just toss
where,
it.
Where do you buy your hops for this?
So this came from Yakima Chief. Did this come from Yakima Chief? It may have not. I take that back because I don't think they have this hop. This is El Dorado. Hmm. So El Dorado is fairly new in the grand scheme of things. Hop.
It's nice.
So we've done a lot of single hop pale ales. One for us to understand what that hop it contributes to the beer, because we 10 barrels, 20 kegs, we'll go through that in no time in the tap room, and then our consumers get a chance to look at or smell, taste a beer that has a single hop, and then we'll do a blend. So we at one point we had three different single hop beers, and we blended all three of those into a blend, and so the consumer could or customer could say, all right, these are the single hop, you know, varieties. Great, I got that. This is what they like in a blend, and see how it totally changes the hop varieties. So that's been a lot of fun to do that. I really love the new hop varieties coming out of Germany, like you talked about.
It totally reminds me of the Mandarina, which I've used a number of times.
Mandarina is awesome.
Pale lager, just like amazing kind of fresh, like orange tangerine. Like it just kind of pops to you. You know, and it's not your typical flavor, and this kind of reminds
it's beautiful beer.
I want to ask you some other questions. So you started in 1993, so that puts you in the category of your craft beer pioneer. For some reason, I thought you were like 25 years old coming here. I hadn't met you before. A couple years ago, I talked 26. To Todd Mott, great, you know, old school New England brewer.
Oh, yeah.
Are there New England brewers that you look up to, or that are your peers that you'd like to mention?
Oh, Todd's definitely on the top of that list. So when I was brewing at Tremont, Todd was at Commonwealth in Boston, which is, of any place that closed, I missed the most. It's Commonwealth. Cask beer before cask beer was even no one in the country. And Todd was doing a great job. They used to go there for lunch. And Todd was really a great mentor to me when I had no idea what I was doing. He was always there for advice. So Todd's definitely top of that list. And then Piers, I mean, Dan Paquette and I have been brewing, you know, the same amount of time. And we both went through different places. And Dan and I always, you know, kept in touch. And it was fun to see him go through his iterations of different projects, no pun intended. So those two guys stick out because they're two of the old school Boston guys. Will Myers from Cambridge as well. I think Will started brewing right about the same time I did. And Will and I also both contracted beers at Ipswich. And the two of us, being old school guys, drug our ass in every single time there's a beer at Ipswich being brewed and made sure we were there to supervise and brew and things go well. And I really respect that. And Will, you know, the guy that's been at it that long, still has that level of dedication and commitment. And it really says a lot about him. So, those guys kind of stick out as peers and mentors that I've looked up to.
The question is, where hasn't Todd Mott brewed at in New England? It's really the question.
Have you been to his new place?
I have. Yeah. I have. Yeah, he's in Kittery, and he's a great guy. He's just one of those guys. He's
Tributary Brewing.
Tributary. I mean, like he's one of those guys that like you meet and you immediately, it's like putting on an old shoe. You know, you immediately just...
He also has a well-groomed beard.
No, he's just a super nice guy.
That guy he created, the Harpoon IPA?
Yeah.
And he was at, Portsmouth Brewing?
Yeah.
Did Kate the Great? And what's the version of that he's doing at Tributary?
Todd the Lesser.
Mott the Lesser.
Sorry, yeah.
But you got to give some shout-outs to some New England guys.
Cheers, absolutely.
I'm still trying to learn about this. Fantastic. You know, we're in New York City, and you're right, if so many people are brewing on the West Coast, and like I said, I can find California IPAs in Massachusetts more than I can find, Massachusetts IPAs.
It's changing, though. We've definitely seen a huge improvement over the last couple of years in that we've seen local in Massachusetts become important in a way it's never become important before. Because we have some new brewers who are young, and they've done a great job in making great beer and promoting themselves and making local important. And as a guy who's been at this for a while in the scene, it's been really good to see that. It's been fun to see that.
I think it's awesome that, I'm getting to sit here and drink these beers with you. It's a good experience. And then I completely agree with you that it's all about drinking local and drinking where you're from. And that's what I sort of suggest to you, Jimmy. Like, if you're going to come here and you're going to drink beers, go right to the source, man. It's the best way to drink beers. You're going to get the freshest beers possible from the way the brewer wants you to drink them. You're not going to drink it's not like drinking beers off a shelf that once the brewer lets go of those cans, they don't really know how they've been treated, and it's so much better to drink close to the source.
Maybe that's the Massachusetts identity, is that you want to go to the brewery and drink the beers there. So, but Jay and Mark, quick overview. You guys came together. You will be opening a brew pub mm-hmm. in Hillsbury, Mass.
It's a brewery proper.
Quick, 5-second pitch, whatever.
So, Brewery Sylvaticus, it's kind of a collaboration between Mark and I. We've known each other for a long time. I spent the last 5 years up in Alaska, 49th state, and when Michelle and I were looking to move on, it was kind of a natural fit. We were looking for something that was a little closer to home. Growing up in New York City, we still have a lot of family there, and Mark and his wife were up here on the farm, and we really kind of, Mark and I really bonded over this kind of, from the earth, from the wood, kind of sourcing things, and on the farm, him having the hop farm there, growing ingredients, and this kind of dream of building something on that farm. I think it really grew together between the two of us, and that is our long-term goal, is to build our kind of dream facility on his farm there. He's got 43 acres. It's in a great location right on the Merrimack River. So to get there, we're bootstrapping Sylvaticus.
It's going to be
in downtown Amesbury.
Where you can go and buy pints, you're on the river.
So, yep, we're utilizing the ability to have a pour license and sell beer
directly. Why Amesbury, Mass? So, you said it was a beer town.
Well, what brought me to New England to begin with is that my wife was born and raised in Merrimack, Massachusetts. We met in New York City. I'm a New Yorker, born and bred. But I've been coming up here for years, as a vacation spot. And my in-laws had this beautiful farm with massive amount of acreage. And I would come up and I'd spend a week, 2 weeks, 10 days, whatever I was doing, a weekend. And every single time I came up here, I sort of dreaded going back home. because it was just such an epically beautiful place. And my in-laws, you know, it was just them too. Just this older couple in this beautiful environment. So when the opportunity came to buy the place, I didn't hesitate. You know, I chucked my 43 by 100 square foot lot in New York for 43 acres and didn't look back. And Savannicus is sort of comes from the derivation of savage or of the wood. And that really is inspired from that farm. And it's me, I mean, this probably, I have 43 acres and about 8 of it is cleared. So there's a lot of walking trails and you feel like you're in God's country, if there is a God. And you just, it's just this epically beautiful place. And it was what inspired me to come up to New England. Like, moving to New England was a no-brainer to me. When I got here, Jay was up in Alaska, and I was like, you really need to come check out this place because I think you'd get it as well. And when the minute he came, he felt the same. So for us to transition into a place, I mean, to open the brewery at the farm is an enormous undertaking that's going to need a little bit of a step process. So hence why we're opening in Amesbury. But Amesbury is the next town over, and it's a serious beer town. People like beer, and there's no brewery there. And we'd like to be proud to say...
There's a beer bar, there's a beer store.
There's a craft beer cellar, you know, there's multiple beer bars, but there's no brewery. There used to be, Cody Brewing used to be in Amesbury, but it has since passed. So we are very fortunate to get this really beautifully epic spot right in the center of a beer town and sort of plant our flag and say, hey, we're going to brew for this community. This is what's the most important to us. And down the road, when we need to expand, it'll turn into the farm, which is
we're
a couple of miles down the road.
You guys open it, but you know, how do you define a beer town? Like in New York City, everyone drinks beer, but everyone drinks wine, everyone drinks cocktails. Mm-hmm. Like you're saying Amesbury is a beer town. Is Salem a beer town?
Yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to put the brewery here, I live here and my family's been here for over 100 years, is that we saw that Salem consumers bought a lot of craft beer, just based on our history. And it was a no-brainer for us in that if you look in the North Shore of Boston, there's certain communities that just sell a lot of beer, and Salem was one of them. But there's also, to me, there was an emotional connection because my family's been here for a long time and being able to do that. Across the river here is an old thread mill that my great-grandmother and grandmother worked at. My grandmother lost her finger there. Right? So we have some connections to like the community, so to put a manufacturing facility.
You have the authentic accent.
Mm-hmm. I kind of lost my accent a little bit because I went to school in Boston. But anyways, it was a combination of emotional, but also that from the business standpoint, there's a lot of craft beer, good beer consumed within Salem. I think Amesbury is the same way. My in-laws live in Amesbury, so I'm there all the time.
Well, that's good to know.
So you guys will see me.
You know, that's funny because your family, I had a conversation with my mother-in-law who works in the Whittier home.
Yeah.
And I'd heard some connection between the Whittier home and you. So why
John
tell,
Greenleaf
tell
Whittier,
us more about that.
The great poet.
That's my wife, Mary Ellen, my wife, who's the co-founder of Notch. Her family, that's her. So she has to answer that question. I can't.
Small world, New England.
It
isn't
is.
It?
It's great. It's good.
Let's make a toast. And
cheers. Cheers.
Anybody, cheers. Chris, you want to ask these guys a question? What they're planning? Because we haven't heard
where
so much
is
about
Barry?
Right in the center of downtown. If you the space, ironically, we're sitting in your old your boiler room space,
yeah.
Right? The our brewery is the old boiler room space for the Lower Mill Yard in Amesbury proper. We're right on the Riverwalk, which they are
in the
process of redoing.
Yeah.
So you'll be able to just walk right past. At the end of the Riverwalk, it dead ends at our brewery.
The smokestack, you know the smokestack downtown?
Yeah.
That's our building.
Wow, you guys are
the boiler
well.
Plate is in our space.
Yeah,
good
yeah.
For you guys. Yeah, that's a great area. Fantastic.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to you coming to drink some beers.
Let's make a cheers to everybody.
Cheers.
Thank you. Everyone, just one more time. Say your full name and your affiliation. Want to wrap
Mark
Zapp,
Savaticus Brewing.
Chris Loring, Notch Brewing.
Jay Bullen, Brewery Savaticus.
Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our sponsor, Union Beer Distributors, supplier of world-class ales and lagers. This is Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our engineer, David Tadisher, who's going to piece this together. And this will be our New Year's, show. Broadcast live. See you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.